Welcome to the Negotiations Ninja podcast, where we develop and deliver the most engaging negotiation content and training in the world. We host negotiation experts, business people, and entrepreneurs, and discuss what works, what doesn't work, and how we can improve our negotiation skills. What's going on, everyone? It's Throwback Thursday. We're throwing back to an amazing episode with Mr. Robert Greene, author of many books, the most famous of which include The 48 Laws of Power, The Laws of Human Nature, Mastery, War. I mean, the list goes on and on. Had a wonderful discussion with Robert about the nature of power and what power actually is. And I think he does a fantastic job of illustrating for us how to leverage power and how to use power. Power in and of itself is not a bad thing. And he gets into a really deep discussion about it. Loved this conversation. I think you will too. Enjoy. Hi, Robert. How are you?
I'm fine, Mark. How are you doing?
I'm very well. It is such a privilege and a pleasure to have you on the show.
Well, thank you. Pleasure is mine.
I am absolutely in love with your books, and I just finished reading the 48 Laws of Power, and I know that you have a brand new one out as well, and we're going to definitely get into that. But for those of you who don't know who Robert is, first of all, have you been living under a rock? Second of all, Robert, maybe you could give the listeners a bit of a brief background as to who you are and what you do and your most recent book as well.
Well, basically, I'm just a writer. I don't have anything else I do. I've been writing my whole life. I have a background in journalism. I worked in Hollywood for a while. And then about some years ago, I met a man who asked me if I had any ideas for a book. He was a book packager. And I kind of improvised the idea that would turn into the 48 Laws of Power. And he got very excited and he said, I think there might be something there. I'll pay you to live while you write that book. And basically, it's sort of an epiphany for me because I've been wandering my whole life. I was in my mid-30s. I had my calling in life besides writing. I couldn't figure out what to write. And so I was desperate and I made that book. I put everything I had into that book and we sold it and it was a big hit. It took a while to grow. I mean, it wasn't like an instant hit. It kind of grew organically, sort of took off in various communities like on Wall Street and in hip hop and the rap world, etc. And so since then, I've written five other books. I wrote The Art of Seduction, which is a sort of a sequel to The 48 Laws. And then my version of The Art of War, called The 33 Strategies of War. And then I did a book with 50 Cent, who's a big fan of The 48 Laws. And we wrote a book together called The 50th Law, which is about the power you can have in life when you're fearless. And then my fifth book was Mastery, which came out 6 years ago, which is about how to become a master in your field, how to discover what you were meant to do, your calling in life, and how to master it and reach a high level of creativity in your field, whatever that is. And then last year, my most recent book, The Laws of Human Nature, came out, which is kind of a culmination of all the different subjects I've been studying for over 20 years. That kind of synthesized everything I've learned about people, about psychology, about power. So it's sort of the ultimate kind of guidebook on how to deal with people and how to know yourself on a deeper level.
Love it. And having read The 48 Laws of Power recently, I found it super, super interesting. And one of the things that I think is really creates a good parallel to what a lot of my listeners do. They're procurement people, salespeople, crisis negotiators, and negotiation and dealing with power is sort of what they do for a living. And it's an integral part of their lives as professional negotiators. And I find so many other people, and many of us in general, we try to default to the can't we all get along mentality versus how do I utilize this situation to drive for more value? Are we being naive when we're saying things like, hey, can't we all get along?
Generally, we are. I mean, there are different kinds, obviously, of negotiating situations, as you well know. There's some that are definitely more adversarial, in which it's more of a zero-sum game. There's some forms of negotiation where you are aiming at, I hate the word, but for kind of a win-win where both sides are relatively happy and you have an ongoing relationship. There are different kinds of negotiations. But in general, I find people err surprisingly more on the side of being too nice, letting their emotions get in the way, not realizing it's a business, and you have to be practical, and they tend to undersell themselves. Now, there are other people, obviously, the sharks out there, who are go the other way, and they're super aggressive. And I would say maybe 5-10% of people are like that out there. It's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy, which I talk about in the 48 Laws when I talk about boldness and how boldness can kind of overwhelm people if you show a degree of a high level of confidence, even bordering on arrogance. Some people might be put off, but they're generally intimidated. So the attitude you bring into a negotiating situation will play a major role. And generally, I think people err on the naive thing a little too nice.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Something that a lot of people think of power and how power works is they believe that there's a distinct lack of morality in power. And so the question naturally becomes, is power amoral?
Well, I believe the phenomenon of power itself is. That's not to say that morality doesn't have an extremely important part to play in our civilization. We can't survive without some kind of standard that people must abide by. But power itself is a kind of an amoral game. And I think we're not aware of that. We tend to want to believe in the fairy tale version of humanity. So you look at business, you look at the dynamic in business, it's pretty much quite ruthless, particularly in the world today where it's such a competitive environment.
Yeah.
And when you have a large company, let's say a large tech company like a Google or an Amazon or a Microsoft, the dynamic you have is you have to crush all of your rivals, all of your enemies. And at the same time, you might have a slogan such as don't be evil, but you're ruthless. You're out there to get market yeah, share.
Exactly.
You're out there to get market share and dominate. I mean, look at Amazon. And so they're not, you know, when Amazon decides to corner every bit of the market that they can, they're not necessarily thinking of the higher moral or ethics of the people they're putting out of business. They're not thinking of what may be for the greater good of the economy as a whole or the country as a whole. They're thinking of themselves. They're thinking about power. So, and when a politician is running for election, he or she wants power and wants to hold on to power. In my book, I want you to be aware of that. And I want you to also not feel ashamed about this. Because there's a great deal of shame surrounding the concept, as if you're being ugly or you're not a good person when you do that. In one of my books, my version of The Art of War, I discuss Gandhi as a brilliant strategist. And he was. So if someone like Gandhi can use strategy in helping in the fight for independence against the British, then, you know, that pretty much indicates really the power is an amoral game. I compare it to chess. When somebody, you face an opponent and they beat you, it's checkmate, they take your queen, etc. It's not personal. It's not emotional. It's not that they're evil. It's just that they're good at the game. And that's how I want you to approach it.
Yeah, fantastic explanation. I think a lot of people, especially when they hear something like lax morality or amoral, they automatically default to thinking that's immoral. That's not necessarily true. It just lacks the scope of morality. And so when people think of power, they think of corruption and all of that kind of stuff. And it doesn't necessarily have to be that way.
Well, if you believe in a cause, like I believe very firmly in global warming and a staunch environmentalist, you're not going to save the planet, which is in dire situation right now, unless you understand power, unless you understand politics, unless you understand all the odds that you're facing and all the interests that are not going to block you or obstruct you. So you have to understand strategy. And once you've entered the level of strategy, you enter the level of a power game, and you have to leave morality behind. And I fault a lot of people on the social justice side for not taking in consideration the fact that what you're really after is winning this particular battle and not about proving yourself or yelling louder than others or coming off as a saint. You believe in a cause like saving the environment. And so you have to be strategized and you have to think in terms of power. And once you do that, I believe you leave behind the realm of morality in some degree.
Yeah, 100% agree with you. I think the thing that I love most about the book is that you're very explicit about judging people by their outcomes of their actions versus right. their stated intentions. Why do you believe it's more important to judge people by the outcome of their actions versus their intention?
Well, it's very simple. People can say anything that they want to about their intentions. People are often not even honest with themselves about what they're intending to do. Everybody has a cover story. Oh, I'm not aggressive. Oh, I'm not a narcissist. Oh, I wasn't really after power. Nobody wants to admit it. And I talk about that in my book, my new book, Laws of Human Nature. I have a chapter on aggression, and I call it the aggressor's narrative. An aggressive person, and the icon I talk in the book is John Rockefeller, the first billionaire on our planet. He never felt as if he was aggressive. He never felt that he was putting hundreds of thousands of people out of business. He felt he was doing this for a great cause. He was bringing order to a very chaotic business environment, the oil industry. And so aggressors have a narrative. People tell themselves, I have the best intentions. I'm an angel. I want to save the world. I'm all for the good of mankind. And I'm telling you, don't listen to that. Look at their actions. Look at the results of what they're doing. Machiavelli, who's a, kind of one of the guiding spirits of the 48 laws, calls this the effective truth. The effective truth of a person is the results of their actions. That is the truth that you want to look at. Actions don't lie. And so when he was analyzing Italian politics in the 16th and 15th centuries, he looked at Pope and the Vatican, and he said, they might say all of these great things about religion, about the Catholic religion, but look at the results. It was all about power. And so look at their actions and what they do and not on the words that they say. Because people will say anything. They'll justify anything they do with words. We're brilliant at that. We're geniuses at coming up for rationalizations for what we're doing. And it's always a rationalization that makes us look better.
Yeah. Our entire human history is built upon the rationalization of evil and how people use that, especially in negotiations when they're trying to create a perception in the mind of the other party that their intentions are going to be different than their actions. In fact, you speak about that in law number three, where you speak about masking your intentions. You say you're basically describing the concept of misdirection and how misdirection may actually benefit someone. And I love how you describe setting a pattern and then breaking that pattern later. Could you walk the listeners through sort of what you mean by masking your intentions and using misdirection?
Well, people tend to be mostly an open book. They come into a negotiation or a meeting or any kind of situation like that, and they pretty much, you can read what they want, who they are, their character, their goals, their intentions. And once you know what they want and what they're after, and you're the kind of person that's able to disguise what you're after, you have the advantage. If we come back to chess and it's a game, oh, this isn't really about chess here. If you know what your goals are and the other person doesn't know what you're after and they can read you, but you can't read them, you're at a constant disadvantage.
Right.
So, you know, it's not like you have to be extremely Machiavellian and evil or whatever, but don't be such an open book. Don't lay out all your cards out on the table. Make it seem so people in their first impressions are very important and they're kind of judging you on that. And so I noticed like, 50 would do this all the time. I watched him in various negotiation situations. He was a master negotiator. He would come off as very nice and sweet, playing against his reputation as this kind of thug rapper. And people would be disarmed. And then at the last minute, he would suddenly reveal, on like the third or fourth meeting, he'd suddenly reveal his tough side and what he was really after and how he was kind of playing hardball. But by then they were charmed and they were lured in and they didn't want to walk away from the table. So he was great at kind of misdirection and making people think he was one thing and then he was another. So if you have the ability, the plasticity, the theatrical quality to play with appearances and show people one thing and then do something that goes against them the second or third time, yeah, they might think you're crazy or yeah, they might lose a little bit of trust. So you've got to be careful. You can't be schizophrenic about it. But it's a game that you should be willing to play because it's extremely powerful. Battle strategy, any kind of strategic situation, is all about finding leverage. It's all about finding some kind of advantage to play with. And the advantage of you know more of what's going on than your opponent is probably the ultimate advantage you can have.
Yeah. I think that ties in really well into Law 17, where you say keep people in suspense by being unpredictable, especially in the sales and B2B procurement space. It's a lot of salespeople can begin to predict how a buyer or procurement person will negotiate because that same negotiation tactic or the same, you know, go-to-market tactic has been used over and over and over and over again. And so we become predictable. And so our counterparties learn to plan for like the obvious moves that we plan to make. And so they build stuff into their negotiation to take into account that so that they come off better off in the end. And I think it's a skill of becoming more unpredictable and how important it is to always be learning and applying new techniques and tools to our negotiations. It's almost critical so that we can thwart the predictability of our actions.
Oh, yeah. Well, you'll get no argument from me on that, for sure. You know, a lot of what I talk about in my book about strategy, like Law 48 is about assume formlessness.
Yeah.
So it's all about never repeating the same strategy twice and being creative and being in the moment. And, you know, in negotiation situations, I always tell people to be in the moment, to look at your client or the person that you're negotiating against and measure them. And don't fight the last battle. Don't think of the last situation you were in. Drop all your preconceptions and be like a great samurai warrior. You're in the moment. You're measuring your person that you're negotiating with or against, and you're tailoring your approach to what you read off of them.
Yes.
And sometimes it pays to be aggressive and intimidate. Other times it pays to stand back and charm people and get them hooked so that they want to be with you and that to walk away at some point will be painful to them. So you vary your methods depending on the people you're with. That's the ultimate kind of power that people can have. And once again, I bring it back to Machiavelli. He said that the great limitation that people have is they rise to power. Let's say you're a salesman or whatever, or an executive. You rise to power with a particular strategy or strength that you have, whether that's being hyper-aggressive or whatever it is, or being super charming. And you don't know how to vary it, and it becomes your fallback position every single time. And circumstances are changing. People are different. And what worked in the past won't work in the present.
There's a great book that a professor at Harvard, his name is Michael Wheeler, wrote called The Art of Negotiation, How to Improvise Agreement in a Chaotic World. And one of the metaphors that he uses in the book is how jazz musicians are able to move and shape the music according to their needs, the audience's needs, the way the other players are playing the music. And so often we get stuck in this rut of always doing the same thing and we don't improvise. We're not able to improvise. Is there a way that speaking of the 48th law being formless and sort of Wheeler's comparison of improvising, how do we practice that? Is there a way that we can practice formlessness?
Well, yeah, I have a chapter in my war book, my 33 Strategies of War, on what I call presence of mind. And it's sort of a military term where great generals are able to sort of be in the moment. Napoleon was absolutely brilliant at that, but there were a lot of others, Lord Admiral Nelson. And to not let their fear or their emotions or their excitement get the better of them, to always sort of keep themselves on an even keel. And so generally what will push you off that position and will make you become predictable is that you get intimidated, you get afraid. Your adrenaline starts pumping through you and you lose some control. And when you feel that coming, you'll just simply revert to strategies you've used over and over and over again. You won't be alive to the moment. You'll be thinking about the past will be looming up and all the things that have made you afraid in the past. So the key is to maintain a degree of calmness in the moment and to sort of control your emotions. Emotions are the great hindrance in any kind of negotiating your strategic situation. Yes, it's good to feel when you have to close a deal or you have to fight a battle. It's good at some point to feel excitement and that energy when it's time to confront the enemy. But in the earlier stages, you need to be as free of emotions as possible. And all of my books are training manuals on how to develop that kind of self-mastery. And I would direct them to chapter 3, the 33 Strategies of War, which I discuss famous generals who learned to count what I call counterbalance their emotions. So if they knew that in certain situations, they would tend to be afraid and fearful, they learned to overcompensate that by being a little more aggressive than they would usually be. And that would kind of put them in a sort of a middle zone that was the right place to be in. So basically, it's having a degree of self-control and being alive in the moment, and not letting things from the past and fears kind of color what you're perceiving in the moment. That's sort of what I would say.
Yeah. I think it really requires whoever decides to take on improving themselves when it comes to all of these things, it requires them to have quite a bit of self-awareness, which I mean, obviously is something that I think 50 Cent has when he co-authored the 50th Rule with you. And you both talk about the concept of fearlessness. Why is fearlessness so important? And it's not necessarily fearlessness so much as like managing your fear. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, it's not fearlessness in the sense of, you know, I'm going to push people around. I'm not afraid of anybody. I'm going to go out there and expose myself to dangerous situations. It's more banal than that. So there are different levels and different kinds of fears that you're not even aware of. So, for example, you're afraid of being different from other people. So your tendency will always be to conform and do what other people are doing and dress like other people and use the same strategies and ways of talking. And you'll think that you're just fitting in, you're being, you know, a loyal team player, whatever. But basically, you're riddled with fear and you're afraid of standing out. You're afraid of being different. You're afraid of developing your own negotiating or sales style. And what makes people successful in life is not the cookie cutter approach. It's not like being like other people. It's being yourself. It's being unique. Everybody, even in business, who isn't successful at all, there's something unusual about them, something different. And that's what you want to bring out. So that's one fear. You're also afraid of doing things on your own. You constantly want other people to help you. You become dependent on people. And the ability to be self-reliant, be able to do everything yourself, and not wait for other people to help you and not simply think, oh, this person's going to rescue me from that situation, or I need to learn from this great master. Instead, learning to have the skills to stand on your own so that when people abandon you or don't show up, which happens all the time, you don't panic. You have your own skills. You have self-reliance. There's fear of death that I talk about. There's fear of confronting people. There's fear of being seen as not a good person. Don't be afraid to be bad. Sometimes you have to be bad. So on and on and on. So that's what that book is about. It's more about looking at yourself. And the worst person in the world is the person who thinks that he or she has no fears. Oh, I'm fearless. I'm not like that at all. Well, everybody has fears. We're all riddled with them. And the difference with 50 is he knows that and he's overcome it. He's aware of his fears. He dealt with it every day on the streets of Queens as a drug dealer, as a 10-year-old boy. So he knows that he had fear, and he knows how to overcome it. So you need to confront what you're afraid of before you can begin to work on it.
I find that in negotiation, one of the major fears that people have is asking for more than they expect to get. And it's almost like the fundamental rule of negotiation. And yet, most people don't do it. They don't do it because they have this fear of rejection and this fear of ridicule that is just sort of implicit that they carry around like baggage. And I think one of the big ways to overcome that fear is really through your planning, through your strategizing, which you preach about in the 48 Laws of Power. In fact, in Law 29, you say plan all the way to the end. In fact, recently I've heard that Western negotiation style is more about action and Eastern negotiation style is more about planning. Especially what we're seeing right now in politics between, you know, China and the US and China and Canada when it comes to the types of negotiations that are going on. Do you think that that's just a result of us culturally that, you know, as Westerners, we were more prone towards action? Because, I mean, based on our history, I would suggest that that's not correct. I mean, you look at the work of Machiavelli and how the Medicis rose to power. There was tons of strategy in that. And yet today we're seeing not so much.
Well, it's a very good question. You know, everybody thinks that they're a strategist, just like everybody thinks they have good intentions. And, you know, there are levels of strategy. So there are people who think 6 months down the road or who pick a fight with China over tariffs and think, well, our economy is good. I can push them around. And there's a strategy there. But the person that thinks longer, that thinks of the longer game, that's able to elevate themselves above the moment and go further into the future, you enter the level of what we call grand strategy. And grand strategy means you have a greater vision of where you might be going. You're clearer about your goals You're clearer about the different circumstances that might intervene and push you off course. You've thought more thoroughly about the overall situation, not just the business side, but the political side. Von Clausewitz had the famous expression that war is politics by other means. So war involves politics. They're all intertwined. And so the advantage that the Chinese have, and I'm not saying that they're necessarily going to prevail in a great sense, because they do have their own weaknesses, and their weaknesses are in some ways political, but it's also their strength. But they are used to thinking in much longer term. They have a plan. They have a plan 5, 6, 10 years down the road about how they're going to transform China. And they don't have to deal with Congress or the messiness of democratic politics. So their centralized government, their centralized economy, they have much more degree of control than we do. If they want to jiggle their interest rates or the currency exchange rate, they can do that and we can't. And so they are at an advantage in this battle. They're seeing further down the road than we are. And I tell people that all the time. What will doom you in any project, whether it's writing a book or doing a startup, is that you are not clear enough about your goal. You're not clear enough. You haven't thought things through enough. You can never think things through perfectly. Circumstances will come up. Von Clausewitz calls it the fog of war. Things will come up that you didn't expect. But to the degree that you think more, that you plan more thoroughly, that you think of all the parameters, of you think where you want to be 2, 3 years down the road, you're an advantage over your opponent that is merely reacting. So the Western style, I think you're onto something, is more kind of react, and take action for the sake of action and being dramatic. And the Eastern Asian style of strategy, which in many ways is superior, is more about stepping back, is about waiting, is about playing the long game. Now, you know, it's a generalization, but it's something that is throughout Sun Tzu. And there are Western examples of it. I think that Napoleon on the battlefield was very much in the Sun Tzu way of thinking. And there are plenty of examples in the West of people like that in business and politics. But in general, we are too seduced by the dramatic action. Our leaders aren't trained to think longer term. I mean, in politics in America, for instance, you know, it's hard to think long term because you have to react to this hyper news cycle that we're in. And you don't have the luxury of thinking, well, here's my plan 4 years down the road for improving my city or my state or the country. And in business, you're facing the quarterly report if you're a public company. And it's brutal. So I understand the pressures that people have. I call this tactical hell. So if on the highest level, we can talk about grand strategy. And in my books, I discuss some great examples of grand strategy. Below that, we have strategy, which is still on a high level, and you're still thinking ahead, but maybe less than the highest level. Then below that, you're being tactical. You're never elevating to the level of strategy. You're simply reacting to events that are happening in the moment. And once you enter this tactical hell, you can never get out of it because you create your own problems. You simply are always reacting to problems that are almost often of your own creation, and you can't lift your mind above the moment because you're so immersed in the battles that you're facing day to day. So that's my kind of long-winded way of answering your question.
No, I'm 100% agreement with you. I think it's almost implicit in what we do. It's built into the structure of our society. I mean, you look at quarterly reports, for example, in publicly traded companies, you're basically just driving for the higher ticker price, right? I mean, that's essentially what you're doing for in terms of driving shareholder value. All your shareholders really care about and all the analysts care about is the next quarter's results, not necessarily what your long-term plans are. And I think that kind of thinking leads us into a place, yeah, where we're building strategy for the next quarter, but not necessarily for the next, you know, 5, 10, 15 years. And I think it does us a disservice.
Yeah, I was on the board of directors for a publicly traded company, American Apparel, which has since gone under, belly up. And I saw firsthand this problem because, you know, it was founded by a very charismatic CEO, Dov Charney, who had his own issues, which we won't go into. But, you know, the fashion, the world of apparel is a very difficult environment because he built a brand that had a very specific spirit to it that was very successful, kind of sexy, erotic, sort of playing on things from the 80s. But then it came time to adapt and change because millennials weren't necessarily buying this. They weren't so into it. Young girls, which were our biggest audience, sales were starting to slow. And so you had to be able to step back and adapt and think in longer term of where to take the company. And I kept telling him, let's have a meeting of the minds. Let's do a retreat. Let's bring the board and your top lieutenants together, and let's map out a future course for American Apparel that will fit with the changes that are going on in taste. In my book, The Laws of Human Nature, I have a chapter on generations, on how humans form generations and how a generation shapes how you look at the world. And if you're in business, you have to have your finger on the pulse of the zeitgeist. You not only have to know what's happening now, where people are now, but you have to think about where they will be in a year from now. That was the genius of Steve Jobs when he came up with the iPod that revolutionized technology in the 21st century. He thought a year, 2 years ahead of where the next thing was coming. And I was trying to get the CEO to think like that, but nobody in the board and him and all the pressures, it was impossible. And so the company kind of lost direction and just lost touch with its core audience, and it went under. And, you know, this is not an uncommon occurrence, but fortunately, there are counterexamples. It doesn't have to be that way. There are plenty of CEOs. I read an article about a year ago about the CEO of, I think it's Best Buy, who seemed like a very enlightened person who understood that he is a publicly traded company, but he could still navigate these waters with a long-term plan. I know the CEO of Netflix for a while was like that. He may have lost some of that by now. I don't know. Some CEOs are able to navigate these very troubled, tumultuous waters that we're in and to be able to think with more of a vision. But I agree with you. It's extremely difficult in the environment today.
Yeah. Absolutely fascinating stuff, though. And Robert, to that end, I want to thank you for not only the incredible work that you've done with all the books that you've written and released, but also the impact that you've made on people's lives that have read your books. Your books have certainly made an impact in my life, and having the opportunity to talk with you and have you on the show is a great pleasure and a great privilege. So thank you so much for being on.
Well, thank you very well. Thank you very much, Mark. I really enjoyed it.
I really enjoyed it as well. And if people want to follow you online, Robert, how do they do that?
Well, I have my original website, which is Power, Seduction, and War. Power, Seduction, and is spelled out ANDWAR.com. And there you'll find links to all my other books, to the 50th Law, to Mastering the Laws of Human Nature. And then don't think that the art of seduction may not apply to you, because the art of seduction is all about the soft sell. It's actually very valuable for people in negotiating situations, about how to seduce your client and get them to want to meet you more than halfway. So I wouldn't avoid that book and think it's just about dating, because it isn't.
Really, really cool. Again,
and also on my website, you'll find links to my Twitter and my Instagram and all that stuff.
Okay, perfect. So that's going to basically be the launching point from there. People can find you online and other places. Awesome. Yes. Well, again, Robert, thank you so much for being on, and enjoy your weekend.
Same to you, Mark. Enjoy the beautiful British Columbian weather. Very jealous.
Thanks, man. Have a great day. Hey friends, thanks so much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, please share it with friends and colleagues so that they can benefit from it as well. If you find Negotiations Ninja Podcast worthy, please go on to iTunes and give us a cool rating with a nice review. We certainly appreciate every single one that we get, because it helps us to understand who is listening, how they're listening, and what it is they like. If there's something that you would like me to discuss around negotiation, influence, or persuasion, give me a shout. You know how to reach me on social media, or you can get me on my website, which is www.negotiations.ninja.